Hi there, folks, and welcome back to NTI's Japan Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Ziv Nakajima again, and this podcast is brought to you, among others, by Native Shark, which is an online platform for learning Japanese. And what Native Shark do is they make learning Japanese really, really simple. So you just show up, click a button that says study now, and the platform will then show you exactly what you need to learn next based on your progression. Now, this may sound simple, and in practice it is, but the way it's designed means that students who use Native Shark once a day for 4 to 5 months can complete the equivalent of over 2 years of university study. And what they're also unique in is that they teach all of the types of Japanese that you wouldn't normally get in traditional schools or textbooks. And if you've ever studied with one of the more common textbooks that foreigners usually pick up, you've probably noticed that there are a lot of sentences or conversations in there that you'd never really hear in real life, and vice versa. Some of the stuff you actually hear when you're out and about in Japan is never really covered in these traditional textbooks. So this isn't the case with Native Shark. It's very well grounded in everyday spoken Japanese, whether it's casual or formal language. And you can really expect, like one of the students writes in their reviews, you can really expect to be picking up the sort of little nuances that no one would expect a non-native speaker to use. And that's pretty rare for most Japanese courses. So yeah, really, really useful platform. And since you've heard about it here on the podcast, you also get an extra little bonus. If you sign up using the URL nativeshark.com/NTI, we'll link to it in this episode's show notes. That's native without an E, so N-A-T-I-V shark, all one word, .com/NTI. Use that link to sign up and you'll get a double length free trial. So 2 weeks free instead of the one. And you can sign up for that free trial without having to put any credit card or anything of the sort in there. So give it a go. You won't regret it. All right. So we're back with the Clubhouse panel again today. And this one's a really interesting Q&A session with two particular members of the audience. One living here in Japan and thinking about selling his family home, and the other an investor from the US. And both of them were asking quite a few questions, but the common theme was around the value of properties. And more specifically about the potential gains, or rather the lack of potential gains in property values in Japan. Now, this is always a bit of a brain twister for a lot of people who are not that familiar with the market here. And it's certainly very different to real estate arenas elsewhere in the world. So I thought it'd be a good idea to share this snippet of the conversation with you. We also discuss wholesaling, flipping, and other practices that can be a lot more common out of Japan, but are not nearly as popular here. And finally, a bit more info on Akiya, or abandoned homes in the countryside. This topic, too, in particular, seems to be getting very popular. And our last episode, also from Clubhouse, in which we were first joined by Matt Ketchum, the Akiya guru and co-founder of Akiya Indinaka. So that episode is being downloaded in pretty high volume. So we hear your interest, and we're going to have a full-length interview with Matt next week. He's going to be coming to the podcast and talking to us here on the show on exactly what it is that he does and how, what the attraction of these properties is and for who exactly, and a lot more. So stay tuned, watch this space. But for now, here's our Clubhouse panel touching mainly, but not only, on the topic of capital appreciation and value increases or lack thereof in Japan's property market. Enjoy, and I'll see you again on the other side.
Hi, guys. Hey, Ziv. It's Phil in Kobe. How are you?
Good. I thought I recognized the name. How are you, man?
Pretty good. I'm new to the party, so thank you for welcoming me in here to the clubhouse. It's really cool. I'm getting to know it. Hey, I got a question. You know, we wound up holding on to the home in Kobe, and we're living there. And I think I talked to you about this before. We got it for about 4 million yen. And we put about 7 into it. At what point would you say would be a good point to maybe look at selling or possibly holding on to it for a rental for a certain amount of period of time where we would at least get our money back? Right now, you know, we looked into it and we probably wouldn't get our money back. We'd probably lose about $3 million or something like that. But I don't know, you know, if we're going to stay in Japan, still up in the air. That'll probably be decided in the next couple of 3 years. But I know it's kind of a wide range question, but just what's your gut on this?
Well, I would say that you're spot on in saying that at the moment I would definitely not sell. It's very much a buyer's market at the moment with properties and inventory being a bit low. Although Emil has mentioned in some of the past rooms that we've had that for owner-occupiers, residential properties, the market is doing quite well now, doesn't it, Emil?
Yes, but that's, you know, that's in, like, I focus in the Tokyo area, so I don't know what it's like elsewhere. And also, like, the cheapest property I've done is about 55 million yen is probably the cheapest I've done. So it's, you know, it's like 5 to 10 times the size of what Phil is talking about. So even just talking about 2 or 3 million yen profit or loss, that's just like a almost negligible expense. That's just like agency fees are that kind of price that we're talking about for most of the deals. So I think the scale, what my experience, can't really speak to Phil's situation.
Yeah, well, I mean, look, Phil, from our experience, the money that you've put into the property to make it more sort of your dream home is not necessarily the type of capital that would actually raise the value of the property, because often those are going to be things that might be appealing to you, but not necessarily to anybody else buying them, especially if they're cheaper end properties like you're mentioning. So I would maybe put that part of the capital aside and then just see if you're happy getting what you've paid for it originally without the renovation, then maybe wait for next year or in a couple of years and try to get rental income until then. If you're really looking to get back the full capital, so that'll be what, 11 million from what you've described, not sure how doable that would be. It would depend on what exactly was the renovation that you have done to it, but it might be better to, in that case, just focus on rental income, I think.
Okay, I appreciate it, guys. Thank you for your opinions.
Yeah.
I am going to say, in general, my opinion with renovation and any property is, if you're renovating a property, you're not going to get a positive gain. Like, if you spend 5 million yen of renovations, you're not going to get more than 5 million yen on top in terms of sale price. You're not going to get your money back. And especially if the building is quite old, like if you got it for 4 million, then can I ask Philip, what's the age of the building?
Yeah, the building's over, it's just a little over 40 years old. It was built in 79.
Yeah, so a 40-year-old building, it doesn't matter how nice it's been renovated, whoever buys it next, it's basically land value, right? There may be a bit of residual, like, oh, if you spent so much and redone the whole thing, they may think, okay, yeah, it's still a livable house, but at the end of the day, it's still a 40-year-old house. And so it's hard to get residual value in renovations. For buildings that age, especially in Japan. In the West, of course, they do hold it a bit more, but anyone who sees a 40-year-old building is going to consider it land value only.
I'm assuming that's a wooden structure, right, Phil?
Correct.
Yeah, that's pretty much fully depreciated by now, almost double the depreciation life cycle. So, yeah, like Emil was saying, people would be buying it for land value. Kobe specifically is a good place to be shopping in normal time, so you could come maybe a little bit closer to what you put into it in a couple of years' time, but definitely not at the moment, yeah.
Oh, okay, we'll hang in there. I appreciate it. I also just wanted to point out, I think, you know, we haven't, since we paid cash and we don't have a mortgage or interest in any of that, I also wanted to factor in to make myself feel better that I haven't paid rent or a mortgage payment in like nearly 3 years now, so that makes me feel a little bit better.
But one other thing, though, is if you can rent it out, so it's hard to sell with that residual value in the building, but if it's livable and it sounds like you spent quite a bit on making it, so it should be quite a nice place, right? Could rent it out, and the rent will have more upside than selling, like the rental return versus the actual market value of the property. So I feel, yeah, you could actually have make it decent rental return, whereas if you sell it, it's going to be land value only.
Yeah, I'd say like an old car in that case, just ride it till it drops kind of thing.
Thank you, guys.
So look, Matt's come back. So Matt, yeah, are you able to have a to explain sort of what you do.
I'll try to do that and then probably jump off because I'm actually on the way back from Yamagata right now and have an incredibly unreliable connection. So can you hear me still?
Yes, go ahead.
Loud and clear.
Okay, that's good. Although, yeah, let's. So I run a company called Aki and Hinaka with my co-founder who can't be here today, but Parker. And we focus on kind of what the name sounds like, Akiya, aka the abandoned houses, that everybody's probably heard about for the last, I don't know, 6 or 7 years, and also with more rural reaches of Japan. So, I mean, we have dabbled in Tokyo, Kobe, kind of those areas, but really we're working with the spots that nobody else wants to work with. so we certainly do a good bit of kind of off the beaten path work, but we started about a year, not even actually, ago after quite a while kind of dabbling in really just trying to track down what the hell is going on with all of these apparently free houses. And so what we initially determined was, all right, yeah, like most of them are complete shit, you don't want to touch them. But that's not all of them, right? And it actually kind of depends on who you are. Or you might be a carpenter or something like that who has an interest in a very kind of dilapidated building side project. So, yeah, very long story short, we deal with the abandoned buildings of Japan's countryside, and things are actually going pretty well. And I just gotta go.
Thanks, Matt.
Thanks. Yeah, so, yeah, anyone please do follow Matt. We do this room weekly. Wednesdays at 1:30. So, and Matt jumps in and out, like, you know, when he can. So please do feel free to jump in and ask any questions or reach out to Matt via his, if you go into his bio, you see he's got both Twitter and Instagram. So, and his web links as well, akiyanaka.com. So you can reach out to him through one of those channels as well. Let's move on to Jesse. Hey, Jesse, thanks for coming up. What's your question?
Hey, guys, thanks for let me ask questions. So I'm very curious because I'm moving from room to room on the clubhouse, and I saw your the title of the room, and I'm very interested. So I have been to Japan twice, and here I'm in Houston, Texas, so I do quite a bit of fixed flips, just buy those rundown houses, fix them up, and either turn them into rental or sell them. So when I was in Japan, I met several people, just a question for them, but they seems to be not able to answer, or maybe my, you know, it's lost in the translation. So my question is, in Japan, before I even ask any, you know, more specific things, just on general, if I purchase a property, what are the common building cost? Like in here in Texas, the major items, doesn't matter how you treat this house, you're going to pay property tax, you're going to pay homeowners insurance. Those are major costs. So what are the major costs for owning a property in Japan?
So you touched on two of them, the asset tax and the insurance, but then you're also going to need to pay for the management fee to a management company, a real estate agent, to get your tenants and manage your tenants. Okay, so that's usually 1 month. When a new tenant comes, it's 1 month leasing fee. So 1 month of the rent, the agent will take as a lease. You have to pay the agent as a leasing fee. And then standard is 5%. So 5% of the monthly rent is taken by the agent as a management fee, which I think is pretty reasonable compared to I'm Australian, and that's sort of standard rate in Australia as well. And then for the apartment itself, in Japan, the large condos, they're called mansions. So maybe you've experienced that, like heard that or not. But yeah, so when we talk about a mansion, basically that's a condo, condominium apartment. So, and when you own an apartment in a condo, it you need to pay management fee. So that's because there's a management company that manages the building.
That's the equivalent of a HOA in the States.
Okay. And the other one is the thanks, Ed. And the other cost is the sinking fund or the repair fund. So any building maintenance or the scheduled, you know, pipe cleaning or exterior maintenance that happens every few years, etc. That's paid separately and monthly. So, for example, you know, you might pay a management fee of 10,000 yen a month for the management company. And then also another 10,000 yen a month for the repair fund. Okay, and that, and every, all the owners of the apartments in the mansion have to pay that, and that just that accrues. And when maintenance needs to be done, the management company coordinates the maintenance, but they pay for it with the sinking fund cost. So the five big ones: the tax, the insurance, building management fee, building maintenance fee, and the agent management fee.
I'll just add to that a little bit, if I can, Emil. So I would say that the insurance is probably lower, or maybe even a lot lower than what you're used to in the States. So if you take, for example, a typical cash cow, which in Japan is usually a studio or a one-bedroom apartment, let's say up to 25 or 30 square meters. So the homeowner's insurance or the landlord insurance portion of that is usually something like $200 or $300 for a five-year natural disaster policy. And then if you also want to cover a case of a tenant potentially dying in the property, which can happen more often than in other countries because the population here is old, that's another $30 to $50 a year. So all up, you're looking at less than $100, $120 a year in insurance. So it's probably much lower than what you'd be paying in the States from memory.
Are you saying $120 a year?
Yes, but bear in mind that your rental income for these cash cows could be as low as $200 a month or $300 a month, depending on which city or which location you're purchasing in. So it is a lot lower than the States, but the rental income is also a lot lower.
Also, I don't know what the homeowner's insurance in the U.S. covers, but homeowner's insurance in Australia will also cover delinquencies. So if the tenant leaves without paying rent, okay, or just refuses to pay rent, the homeowner's insurance actually covers that, whereas in Japan, that's not covered.
That is a separate policy that the tenant, it's one of the three types of security is that you can ask from a tenant. One of these would be rent insurance, or a guarantee company, as they call it here. So in many cases, that portion of you can definitely, and you should definitely, get insured for that as well, but in many cases that's going to be on the tenant, especially if they can't provide other securities.
Right, got it. What is the amount for the property tax?
Emil or me? Who takes this one?
you can see it.
Okay. So property tax here, there's a big difference between properties that are under 200 square meter in size and those that are over 200 square meters in size. So for the smaller properties, and if you're talking about investment properties, most of them would be under 200 square meter, actually a lot less. In those cases, you get a discount of anywhere between a quarter to half the price. So for properties under 200 square meter in size, the property tax, again, if it's a condo unit, which is usually the most popular asset class for investment, is usually going to be anywhere between 3/4 or all the way up to maybe 1.5% of the purchase price per annum. And if it's if it's above 200 square meters, it could be as much as double that.
Realistically, you won't have a 200 square meter.
Very unlikely if you're going to buy investment properties.
Yeah, making sense, totally. What is the cash flow? Well, I should say this. Assuming with all those costs and those cash call properties, let's say, I'm assuming 1 month's vacancy. I don't know if that's reasonable or not. 1 month's vacancy per 12 months. What is the cash on cash you can expect?
Well, that would really depend. When you say cash on cash, you're usually referring to...
Let's assume I don't have mortgage loan, I pay cash for the property.
If you're paying full cash, then depending on location, there's a huge variance in locations in Japan. So Tokyo would usually, if we're talking about net pre-tax, so including all of your purchase and running costs, but putting aside the cost of unknowns, like your individual income or corporate tax situation and maintenance and so forth, you're probably looking in Tokyo and Osaka between 3-5% at best. In the 2020, we did occasionally see 6% because the market has been a bit softer during the pandemic. But usually 3-5% in Tokyo and Osaka. And in other cities, which could be big cities, just not as familiar to the international crowd, it could go maybe up to 7-8% if you're lucky. And net pre-tax.
That's not bad. That's almost in line with what we see in Texas, those kind of numbers.
Yeah, and I mean, look, the advantages and disadvantages are numerous. So in, I don't know specifically about Texas, but in the States, you could usually factor in some appreciation as a rule, unless a crisis hits. In Japan, I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't bank on any capital growth. As Phil's question just then just probably demonstrated. And the upside, though, is that the tenants, even in the low income levels, which again are the cash cows, even at those levels, the tenants are virtually hassle-free. And the professional companies that you work with are usually, even if they're not super professional, they're usually very... very by the book and reliable. No one's going to swindle you and run off with your money and go out of business and leave you hanging there. So there are advantages. And one of the main advantages, I'm not sure what the situation is in Texas at the moment, but aside from Tokyo and Osaka, properties in Japan are very, very affordable. So there are still places where you can buy high yielding, well, as high as we've just mentioned, individual condo units for as little as $50,000-$60,000, which I think is not an option in the States.
Yeah, it's, so if you're talking about the property in Tokyo, cash flows, that's kind of unheard of if we compare it to, let's say, New York City. There's pretty much nothing in New York City cash flows.
Yeah, similar market.
Yeah. That's interesting. So you are saying Japan, we should not expect the price to appreciate.
Not as a strategy. It's great if it happens, and we have had a few good years between, say, 2012 to late 2017-18, but that's on the back of 2.5 decades of deflation. And because the population and the workforce is shrinking here on the macro level, I mean, they're growing in the big cities, but they're declining in the smaller townships. So generally speaking, on the macro level, Japan's workforce is declining, which means that there's a limit to how much economic growth you can expect here. So it's very much a cash flow market, with any appreciation if and when it occurs being sort of icing on the cake.
Right. That's good analysis. So in the States, we have a lot of people call themselves wholesalers. I'm not sure you're familiar with this concept.
Yep.
Those are the people, you know, looking for the homeowners who are in distress situations, try to get the house very, very cheap. And they sell it. They add on some money and they sell to the end investors. Are those things happening in Japan?
Not as frequently in the States. So there are a few reasons for that. One of them is the fact that because the government here wanted to discourage speculation, and they've succeeded to quite a substantial degree, so they've put in double capital gains tax for anyone who offloads a property within 5 years from purchase, unless they're a registered real estate company. So you would occasionally see wholesalers and short sellers and flippers, but these would usually be professional companies that are registered and licensed and do this for a living. It's not really worth your while because of the taxes and because of the fact that you may not have the connections in place if you're not doing it full time to do affordable renovations and so forth. So it's very much a niche market here. It's not nearly as popular as it is in other countries.
So on that, just to follow up to that. So what we have is there are renovation companies, that's what they do, the flip. So they purchase properties cheaply, and often those properties never go to market. So it will be a seller who, not necessarily distressed, but just doesn't want to go through the wholesale process and have people come to their house regularly, etc. So when they want to sell their property and to an agent, and they'll go to an agent and they'll say, we want to sell it. And depending on their urgency, how quick and how much headache, then they could say, look, the agent can say, look, I know a company that can purchase it right away in cash without worrying about financing and all the viewing, etc. But it's at a significant discount. And so those properties never really come to market. They're not really distressed as such, but they are kind of, you know, they probably could think of them almost in that manner. The seller just wants to get rid of it and he's willing to do it at a discount. So the renovation company will purchase it at a below market price, and then they'll do a renovation of it at a wholesale renovation cost, because that's what they do, and then they'll sell it. And that's basically the flip that happens. It doesn't really work with individuals, though. Individuals can't get access to the same deals. They can't get access to the same level of quick financing, right? Or don't have that cash readily available. And the renovation, they can't get renovation done cheaply the same way that a renovation company does. So so that means that the total cost base has cost more than what a renovation company could get it for. So, and then if you try to sell it, you're going to be competing at selling a similar property, similar square meter size property in a similar building with a renovation company that has done everything cheaper than you. So you can't match their sort of pricing. So the flip by individuals doesn't really happen.
Yeah, the bottom line, it's not really a side hustle thing is here. There are companies that do that as their main line of business. But if you're talking about a private investor who does this sort of thing for some extra profit, that's not really a thing here.
That's kind of opposite than in the United States. The fixed flipper mostly is a mom and pop operation, and the big corporation don't have the efficiency actually to do this thing right. I guess in Japan that's a totally different world, and I can imagine why.
Yeah, it's very different.
A lot of things here are very counterintuitive, not just in that aspect. I mean, as far as tenants go and the lengths of vacancy and how much people want to own a home rather than rent a place, at least on certain income levels and so forth. So the fundamentals of how things work practically are similar, but the underlying forces and the profit drivers are quite different here. They can be quite counterintuitive.
Can we, I just want to do a quick room reset. Okay, it's 2:00. We've been here for half an hour, and we run this room every Wednesday for about an hour or so. It's a foreigner's guide to buying real estate in Japan. I'm a real estate agent. My name's Emil. I'm a real estate agent here in Tokyo. My work is to help foreigners and mixed families. So, you know, often one spouse is Japanese, one spouse is foreign. And it's helped families purchase their own family home, personal home in Tokyo. So not an investment property. And we also act as a mortgage broker. So we have direct connections with the loan offices at the mega banks in Japan. So we can also, I'm also very familiar with how to get financing for foreigners with different types of residency situation, marital situation, employment situation, etc. So any questions you have regarding purchasing your own home, the purchase process, the financing process, feel free to ask. And Ziv to my right, is a buyer's advocate for both residents but also non-residents who are interested in investing in Japan. So investment properties anywhere from, you know, $50,000, $40,000 US, even cheaper, up to much larger. And he does management. And Matt on my far right does Akiya. So the vacant properties in rural areas outside of the major cities that maybe you've heard about that are sold very cheaply. So he helps source those and do the due diligence for those. So any questions you have regarding that, please feel free to push the hand raise icon at the bottom of your screen and you can come up and ask. We'll be here for another 30 minutes. If there is some, like, sometimes, you know, personal information or personal situation you feel not comfortable doing on this public forum, please feel free to reach out to any of us on the direct messaging platforms we have linked in our bio. So in my case, Twitter or Instagram, Ziv as well, Twitter, Instagram, and I think he also likes LinkedIn. And Matt as well has information on his bio. So yeah, please do feel free. One more thing, this room, if you see in the title, is recorded. Ziv has a podcast that he does every week, and he turns this particular discussion as well into a podcast. So by being here, you also acknowledge that you accept this podcast, this being recorded, being put as a podcast. And if not, if you think you said something, and we didn't announce it earlier, if you think you said something and you don't want to be there, please let Ziv know and he can cut that out. But yeah, feel free to, yeah, again, if you don't want to mention anything, reach out to us directly. We've got Adam on the stage. Thanks for coming up.
Hello, Emil.
How are you doing, Adam?
Good, how are you?
Very well, thank you for coming up. What's your question, mate?
So I have a question regarding Akiya. I'm an Egyptian living in Japan for about 9 years now. And I have built my own hotel in Egypt. And it was like an investment. Someone have the land, and me, I've built the building and you know, brought the staff and the everything. And we now working. Not so well because of Corona, but we're there and we had a good winter season. So I am looking forward maybe same opportunity in Japan, but don't know how to reach it. Like someone has a house or a land and want to make a project like a guest house or a small hotel or like this. So I'm not sure where to look for this. If you have any advice, I'll be so much appreciated.
Yeah, Adam, those are all good questions. And to start off with, it's absolutely feasible. They're kind of everywhere. You know, I could point to Minakami up in Gunma. I could point to Yugawara in the Izu region of Kanagawa, over in Omaegasaki and Shizuoka. Really, these pensions is really kind of what you're looking for. Are quite frequent, quite often, relatively cheap to pick up. I would say they probably go for normally between 8 and 15 million yen. That's not to say that they will go for that much. Maybe they'll be under it, maybe they'll be over it, but generally speaking, 8 to 15 seems to be a pretty comfortable area for those places to get into. So far as spinning them up into kind of guest house, share house sort of things like that, really it's just a matter of getting registration either for Minpaku or Minshuku use, which is kind of the difference between are you going to be doing it on the weekends or are you kind of trying to do it full time. But that's really kind of the, so far as the registration is concerned, that's more or less what you need to do to get them functioning. Of course, there's, you know, fire and everything that goes into that. But yeah, the properties are out there. I'm working with a number of people right now in a number of different cities who are spinning, who are doing exactly what it is you've asked about. So it's technically doable. It's actually doable. And usually it doesn't cost more than, you know, I'd say about 150 US. But that's usually not all the time.
I would maybe just add to that, Adam, that you really want to look, because of the Minpaku and Minshuku regulations and compliance here, and Matt can elaborate on that, you really want to make sure that you've got the either the staffing or the management company accessible to actually run the places. That might be one of the biggest challenges in the Inaka, in the countryside.
A lot of the places we're working right now are really pretty much a family operation. So depending on how big, again, a lot of these things depend on, you know, exactly what the circumstances you are operating in. But there are quite a few, you know, either solo or more or less family operations that are also kind of getting their business going at the moment. But yes, to the point, if you do intend on having staff and management companies involved, you should definitely be speaking with them as well.
So there you have it, another Clubhouse Q&A panel. Really good questions and pretty good answers, I thought, as well. Hope you found value in it. And again, we're on Clubhouse every Wednesday, 1:30 p.m. Japan time, the Japan Real Estate Room in the Japan Real Estate Club. Feel free to join us if you're free. We'd love to have a chat with you and answer any questions that you might have. And who knows, you might even end up being featured here on the podcast. Now, before we go, we're also, as always, going to tell you and also link to our other sponsor's website. That's Hiroshi Shimizu, immigration lawyer and administrative scrivener. If you're thinking about moving here on a more permanent basis, or you are already in Japan on some sort of a more temporary visa and you want to switch to a longer term or permanent one, and also if you're considering setting up a local company or branch office of a foreign company, and you've got any sort of business or visa-related inquiry, or even if you just want to find out what your options are on any of these topics, feel free to contact Hiroshi Shimizu. You can find him at japanimmigrationexperts.com, and he can help you set up a company, apply for any kind of visa, or just provide you with the best advice and extremely affordable consultation related to these topics. And he's already done that for many of our listeners and our clients. So feel free to reach out to him. Again, that's japanimmigrationexperts.com, all one word, and you'll be well on your way. And that's it from us for today, folks. Hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Japan Real Estate Podcast. Do share it with your networks and please let us know what you think. So leave us a short rating, review on the iTunes Store, on Spotify, wherever you're tuning in from, or just drop us a line in the comment section or wherever you might have found this episode. We love hearing from you. Hope to have you with us again next time. And until then, have a great day or night ahead. Yoroshiku.